This will be an excellent lecture and discussion. I believe Steve wants you to interact with him. So, welcome after your nice day out. I imagine this was a very good day out yesterday. It was very lovely weather and beautiful place there. And please, Steve, have the floor.
Okay. First of all, I want to thank Dimitris for inviting me, and thank all of you for showing up. I mean, especially at 9 o'clock in the morning after such a day yesterday. I hadn't realized I had already been talked about because since I'm not sure exactly what kinds of backgrounds you people come from and what sort of things would you be expecting to get from me, I'm going to start off by saying a little bit about who I am. And in the course of the next couple of hours, I hope that you will take the opportunity to ask questions. You can put your hand up or interrupt me. I've got a lot of stuff, as it were, but how much of it I actually cover will depend on what strikes me as the pace of how we're going here. Because if there are certain basic issues that you want to bring up immediately, we can spend time on those. Okay? So it's not like I have a sort of, you know, preformed agenda here, but I will start off by saying something about who I am, because it's always good that you know who's talking to you. And so I'm Steve Fuller, and I'm a professor of sociology at the University of Warwick. My original training's in history and philosophy of science. That's where I got my PhD in from the University of Pittsburgh. And I'm primarily known for this field in a way that I've started called social epistemology. And that's the title of my first book. You'll see it up there. And it's also the title of a journal that I founded in 1987 that's still in existence today. This was a, you know, since we're talking about interdisciplinarity here, this was a consummate interdisciplinary project, okay? I'm someone all of whose academic degrees have been in more than one subject. And so I've always, as it were, always already been interdisciplinary. But there's an interesting question as to, you know, where do you need interdisciplinarity in a world that's already populated by disciplines? And so, in a sense, this gives you a sense of how I founded this thing called social epistemology. Because basically, if you were operating in the 1980s, you've got these fields: history, philosophy, and sociology of science. And all of them are meta-science disciplines. That is to say, they are concerned about second-order questions, sort of epistemological questions, ethical questions, generally speaking, the sort of larger questions about the nature of science, but looked at from these different disciplinary angles: history, philosophy, and sociology. Now, the interesting thing is that these disciplines, although the people who have been involved in them historically have actually had overlapping expertises, many of them, for example, with backgrounds in the sciences, especially physics, and many of them with, you know, one or more combination of history, philosophy, and sociology. But what we were seeing by the 1980s was a kind of polarization taking place within this field, where in a sense disciplinization was happening. And so on the one hand, you had disciplines like the history and sociology of science, which were largely empirical disciplines, historically oriented disciplines, that is to say, concerned about knowledge as it is actually produced, either in a contemporary sense or in the past, and really not asking the big normative questions, you know, that is to say, what ought knowledge be, for whom knowledge should be, all those sorts of large philosophical questions. They were really bracketing those questions, and more than that, they were saying that asking the normative questions actually made life difficult if you wanted to figure out how knowledge was actually produced. Because if you come into studying knowledge, let's say, with something like Popper's view, right, that science is, you know, bold conjectures and striking refutations, right, this kind of falsificationist view of knowledge. That's a very strong normative view of knowledge. But if you come into studying the nature of knowledge with that kind of viewpoint, you're going to be sorely disappointed at just about everything you see, right, because very little of it actually conforms to the normative ideal. So what do you spend your time doing? Just saying everything's crap? And in fact, this is a very important issue because, in a sense, by the 1960s and 70s, we had philosophers of science, and you may know about Imre Lakatos, L-A-K-A-T-O-S. Are you familiar with him? I'll put him up on the board. Still a very interesting figure. Hungarian, who was a professor at the London School of Economics. And he he had this very interesting approach to the history and philosophy of science, where basically he said, what we ought to be doing is writing the history of science as it ought to have occurred, had the sciences been following the methodologically prescriptive rules, you know, which in his case was a kind of Popperianism, and then in the footnotes put all the deviations, which is the actual history. Okay, so it got to that point, right, by the 1970s, where there was this mess, where there was a sense of, you know, which way is up was a real question, right? Because here we had a very strong philosophical normative perspective that basically say you have to consign the actual facts of science to errors, right? Because no one ever really follows the rules properly, okay? Now that, you know, you might say that's a kind of reductio ad absurdum of a strong normative position. Because if you have a strong sort of sense of, you know, way knowledge ought to be, what are the ideal forms of knowledge, you know, if you have perfect evidence and perfect reasoning capacity, then most of what actually happens looks bad, okay? But generally speaking, the thinking went in the opposite direction. In other words, people took the descriptive aspect of science very seriously. So in other words, they took very seriously the fact that there are many different sciences. They each, as it were, have their own local rules and methods and procedures. And these things vary not only across disciplines, but even vary across nations. So in other words, there's no obvious sense in which there's a universal, let alone uniform, method of science from an empirically descriptive standpoint. There's just lots of different ways of doing science. And so, as you know, in our postmodern world, we like to stick S's at the end of everything. So we have knowledges and sciences and methods and theories, right? And this is kind of the result of this kind of historical, sociological perspective getting a kind of dominance, right? And so then, so what those guys tended to do was to just basically say the normative questions are just misguided. You shouldn't be asking the big normative questions. You should just be figuring out how the local practices of particular sciences work. So we have this kind of divide that's taking place, right, between the normative philosophical side, which in a way is kind of like abstract policymaking, you might say, and on the other hand, this kind of empirical, descriptive, historical side. And they were very distinctive. And social epistemology sort of stepped into the breach, and is basically an attempt to bring these two things together. And that's always been my intention from the very beginning, from when I wrote the first book, and so forth. So in a sense, this is a kind of interdisciplinary project that in a way emerged from divergences taking place in the way in which disciplines were developing, you know, in the final quarter of the 20th century. And that explains kind of the particular cast that this particular field, social epistemology, has. And my basic move was to say, the normative questions are basically right. In other words, you know, Lakatosh is not so off base. There is a sense in which we do need to ask normative questions, if only because we have to figure out what and for whom do we want knowledge, right? There's a question of ends. And in a sense, that's something the philosophers had not stressed enough in the recent past, was the idea that knowledge is not, you know, science and the pursuit of knowledge isn't just about using the most rational methods available, but having a clear sense of what's the point of doing it in the first place. Because it's only once you have a clear sense of what the ends, what the aims of knowledge are, that you can then start asking sensible questions about what's the most rational means to go about pursuing it. Okay, so the ends of knowledge is something that I've highlighted very much in my own writing about social epistemology. Okay, and so, for example, you'll see like the third book that's listed, Philosophy, Rhetoric, and the End of Knowledge, and that word end is meant as a kind of pun. Okay, because the word end not only means aim, right, and goal and so forth, but it also means termination, right, death, extinction. And that point refers to something, I think, about the problem of trying to ask these big normative questions now. Namely, we're in the postmodern condition. And in a sense, that's often the phrase that's used to characterize this general skepticism about this big normative philosophical approach to knowledge. Right? In other words, there is no goal to knowledge, except the local goals that people happen to have whenever they want to produce knowledge. Right? So in other words, the goal, you know, there is no, as it were, capital T, truth. There is no capital O, objectivity, capital R, reality. No, there's just the particular things you're trying to do, you know, so like you want to, you know, and this is, I think, most understandable in the context of technology and so forth, right? We want knowledge for certain kinds of technological reasons. We want to be able to control some aspect of our world, so we produce knowledge in order to do that. And that's a very limited goal, and in a sense, you don't need any fancy epistemology for that, right? Because in a sense, the goal of producing the knowledge is specified outside the knowledge production process, right? It is specified by the client, you might say. You know, for whom is this knowledge? That person decides what counts as adequate then, right? And so when you're in the postmodern condition, right, the whole idea that there being some special goals to knowledge, like searching for the truth, trying to come up with some maximally comprehensive view of reality, that's not really an issue anymore, right? That's just a philosopher's fantasy. That's not really a kind of concrete way of thinking about the knowledge production process. Okay, and part of my project of social epistemology, in a way, has been trying to reassert the idea that there are goals to knowledge independently of the practical applications. So that there is a sense in which one can talk about, you know, why is it that one pursues knowledge even when it's not practical? You know, what's the point of pure inquiry? But it has to be articulated in a context, namely our own, where we have to recognize all the challenges it faces in terms of trying to make this idea good. Okay, so that's kind of where I'm coming from on this. And so one of the things that I've done increasingly, certainly over the last 10 years, has been to be a defender of the university as an institution. Okay. This is, in a way, the university, the idea of the university very much epitomizes what my view of social epistemology is about. Because, first of all, the university is quite clearly a social organization, and it's a very specific, very distinct kind of corporate body with a distinct kind of history and distinct kind of way of doing things. And from a social epistemology standpoint, right, the question you want to ask is, what is the character of the knowledge that is produced under these very specific kinds of circumstances, which are not like any other kind of circumstance under which people pursue knowledge? Okay. And what I would argue, and this is something increasingly I'm spending my time doing, not least in my very last book, which is coming out in autumn, The Sociology of Intellectual Life, is that the university is the institution for pursuing knowledge for its own sake. In other words, that is what the university is for. In a sense, you know, what is the point of the university? That is what it's for. That is its distinct function. Okay? And insofar as the university has now been forced to enter into the market competing with other things, so for example, entering into sort of vocational training market to compete in terms of providing credentials, or entering into the sort of science park market in terms of producing patents and things like this, it is kind of moving away from its distinctive function and systematically disadvantaging itself. Because in a way, it's not so ideally cut out for these more specific functions. It is really cut out for this thing, pursuing knowledge for its own sake. And what exactly does that mean, perhaps, is the question we need to ask. Okay. And in a way, it's very characteristic of our times that universities have been so easily moved away from their classical mission. Largely, I would say, not because they weren't performing that mission well, but because the people who've been leading universities don't know what a university is. Right. In other words, there's a sense in which people who lead universities are always looking to other institutions as their benchmarks, not universities themselves, but, you know, industry or business or something. In other words, they're using other kinds of standards against which to judge universities, as if universities don't have their own standards. And I think one of the best ways you see this is in terms of the way in which metrics get constituted for universities when we rank them and so forth. Right. So, if you're counting patents, you're counting numbers of students, what kind of measures are these exactly? Right, these are very kind of industry-based style measures, right? And there's a sense in which universities have all too easily capitulated to take, as it were, the things that sort of mimic industry-based measures as a way of measuring their own value. And if you go down that route, then it's very easy to lose the point of what you're about, and you end up becoming more and more like these things you're measuring. Okay, and I think one way in which you see this very distinctively is in terms of the disaggregation of the teaching and research functions of the university. Because one of the ways in which universities, as it were, produce knowledge for its own sake in this kind of pure sense is by making sure that the knowledge isn't just captive to the people who produce it. Okay, and this is kind of a very important point that I'm drawing attention to here. Because I think in light of the way in which we think about the production of knowledge now, certainly in terms of the postmodern condition and neoliberalism, there's a lot of network mania going on, right? And social capital mongering and all this kind of stuff where basically the knowledge belongs to those who produce it and the idea is to get as many people as possible involved in the mix. Okay, but the knowledge is theirs. It's those who constitute the network. The knowledge belongs to them. Okay, there is no kind of larger sense that one, as it were, has responsibility for distributing knowledge beyond that, right? So the idea of knowledge as a public good, okay, that's disappearing. Now, the way in which traditionally knowledge was made a public good was not simply by doing research, because of course research, as it's always been, it's been an esoteric activity, right? Research is something done by people who are technically qualified and credentialed with funders, typically of one sort or another, state, industry, or self-funded for that matter. And the point is, research tends to be a kind of an enterprise that, because it is advancing knowledge, is in the first instance always going to be elite. There's no, that's what makes it new. The question then, does it just stay like that? Right? And of course, it is likely to stay like that if it gets crystallized into intellectual property of some form or another, where you put very high tariffs to enable other people to get involved in the process. But see, universities got around that idea through the mandate of teaching. Okay, so it isn't just that you do research in the university, but you have this obligation to teach your research. Okay, and that is to say you distribute it to more than just the people who were involved in producing it or who are the likely people to have some sort of stake in producing it in the future. So you make it generally available. And people will take that knowledge wherever they will take it. So in that sense also, you lose control of it. So it doesn't become proprietary. So, you know, you produce this knowledge, you initially publish it in these journals that only three people read, right? But then you teach it, and you teach it in a more accessible way, and it's the people who get it there, they do something with it, and there the knowledge really spreads and actually has a sort of dynamic force in the society, right? And that was kind of the original idea. That's why von Humboldt, when he founded the modern university, he thought that this idea of the university was a way of dynamizing society. In other words, it was knowledge for its own sake, but one of the knock-on effects of pursuing knowledge for its own sake in this particular way, where you're distributing all the new knowledge on a regular basis to students, is that the society will be dynamized, that the next generation will always be knowing something different from the previous generation. And that actually broke the mold of the traditional university. Because as you may know, right before the early 19th century, universities were largely training grounds for clerics. Right? And you know, lawyers and, you know, people who would administer to society in various ways through the professions. Right? And there was this tendency to just teach what one had taught in the past. And in fact, the most interesting and innovative forms of knowledge that had been going on in Western society prior to the 19th century were happening outside of universities. And there was always an enormous amount of friction on the part of universities absorbing this new knowledge. And I think if you look at the history of the scientific revolution, this is very clear, right? That all the major players are outside the university, with the exception of Newton, who's actually only able to finish Principia Mathematica because the plague ends up killing the classes, and so he doesn't have to teach for a while. So he has a little spare time. But he was hired as a teacher of mathematics at Cambridge. Okay, but everybody else is outside the university system and facing a lot of resistance trying to get this knowledge brought in. And so there have been actually lots of interesting books written about how in the 17th century in particular, the way the Jesuit order in the Catholic Church formed a kind of bridging thing in terms of enabling some of this new knowledge to enter into the universities, which were otherwise quite resistant. In fact, this resistance should not be underestimated, because if you look at the Enlightenment in the 18th century, and you look at people like Diderot, and D'Alembert, and all these people who were, closely associated with the Encyclopedia Project, they really were in an active campaign to undermine the legitimacy of the universities as they existed in that time, right? Which was this training ground for priests. Right, and so these guys in the Enlightenment, as you may know, spent a lot of time traveling around Europe trying to get the kings and queens to establish academies. Okay, and what are these academies? Well, these academies are research institutes that are distinct from the teaching function of the university. So people can actually just go produce knowledge, and the knowledge would then be made directly available to the state. Right, and so the selling point for this was, you will become a more powerful ruler if you have all this up-to-date knowledge delivered directly to your doorstep by having this research institute, a.k.a. an academy. And you can continue to have the universities as training grounds for priests and people like that, but don't confuse the two functions. Okay. In other words, you have this progressive research end that's directed at the state, and then you still have this university thing, which is in the base, you know, which is in the business of training the kind of people who are going to placate the rest of society, keep the order, keep the peace, right? And this was, you know, the French system is very much, you know, this sort of disaggregation of teaching and research in a systematic way, where you don't have this unity of teaching and research. Well, this is the French model. And this is the thing that was being sold in the Enlightenment. And one of the things that made Humboldt so distinctive in the early 19th century was the idea that he thought that the Enlightenment idea could actually be realized in the university structure. That was the novelty, was to actually think the university could be progressive, right, and could be a vehicle of Enlightenment rather than an obstacle to Enlightenment. Okay, so if you were to go back in the 18th century and look at these French Enlightenment guys who are trying to sell all the kings and queens of Europe on the ideas of academies, they're like people, you know, they're like intellectual entrepreneurs trying to sell the idea of science parks and research institutes and stuff like that today. That's what they were like, right? They were part of the, you know, the knowledge economy folks that were kind of, you know, coasting on the early waves of the Industrial Revolution, essentially. They were the ideologues of this. That's how you should think about those guys from the Enlightenment. They are not academics. They are anti-academic, just like a lot of the entrepreneurs today are very anti-academic. Okay? And so I think that's the... And so then the thing about... this is where I think Humboldt's genius, in a way, gets very much highlighted, because the whole idea of being able to reincorporate that dynamic spirit of research into a university structure, so it just doesn't benefit the people ruling the society or the people who can afford to pay for the research, but benefits everyone in a systematic basis. That's the great innovation of the modern university, which is now being torn apart. Because the way that innovation got made was through the unity of teaching and research. In some writings of mine, I've talked about this unity of teaching and research in terms of the creative destruction of social capital. Okay? I'm going to explain that. Now, you know, of course, the phrase creative destruction from Joseph Schumpeter as being kind of the hallmark of the entrepreneur. Okay? And what I'm talking about here is the idea of the university as an entrepreneurial institution. Okay? An institution, you know, so instead of having individuals who are entrepreneurs, we have an entire institution that is entrepreneurial in the sense of constantly, right, reconfiguring markets through the way in which research and teaching interact. And so the idea here is that through research, social capital is built, right, in terms of people invest money, ideas get put together, work is done, products are produced in the forms of paper, patents, whatever, right? But it just doesn't stay there, right? It is creatively destroyed in the sense that it is distributed through the teaching process so that a whole bunch of other people have access to this knowledge as well. And that's where the dynamism comes in, because that then enables a whole new generation, a whole new bunch of people to actually get involved in the process. And then what this does is that, of course, it provides an incentive for the researchers to come up with new forms of knowledge so they can get their advantage again, and then the advantage gets taken away through the teaching process. And so it's a constant cycle, a dynamic cycle of basically reconfiguring knowledge markets over time. And that's what a university is for. The problem that we have now is that these two functions get disaggregated, and so the research pretty much gets colonized by those with the ability to pay for it. So we're back to the old Enlightenment days in that sense. And the teaching just becomes, in a way, very much like universities were in the old Enlightenment days, right? Credentialing process, vocational training to just reproduce society. Right? So in a sense, we're back to the 18th century. Right? And the problem is people think this is progressive. That's not a joke. I mean, you may see here, I've written this book here, Knowledge Management Foundations. That came out about 5-6 years ago. And that book was very much a result of my reflection on the way in which this process I've just been describing was characterized. Because, you know, the way I've just been talking about it, I see this as kind of a return to the bad old days before we had the modern university, where teaching and research were disaggregated, okay? But the way it gets produced by knowledge management people is that this is progress, okay? Because they have a certain view about the university, which I think is one that a lot of university administrators have bought into, largely because they don't know anything about the history of the university. And that's the idea, to put it in the words of Tom Stewart, that the university is a dumb organization, okay? High on human capital, low on structural capital, So it's not well organized, right? And this is the kind of thing Adam Smith complained about in terms of the way the pre-capitalist economies were organized in the Wealth of Nations. This is the kind of thing he would say, okay? And the analysis that follows from this, and this has a lot to do with the fact that it's impossible to keep track of what, you know, here are all these academics being paid so much money, and how do you know what they're doing? How can you judge whether what they're doing is any good, right? You can't count for them in any way, right? This is the kind of general sort of problem that they're referring to, which university administrators have bought into as a diagnosis of the situation. Now, behind this is a certain kind of theory about organizational development, which is to say, that these guys imagine the university as a very primitive organization. So in other words, the university is imagined as an institution that has not changed at all since the 13th century, and that basically it's an institution that its primitiveness is evidenced by the fact that it's trying to do too many things at once, which ought to be disaggregated. So in other words, what they imagine, what the knowledge management people imagine, and certainly what a lot of university administrators imagine today, is that in some way the teaching and research functions get in the way of each other. Right? They get in the way of each other, and they have to be disaggregated. Right? And this is there's a certain kind of theory of organizational development about functional differentiation. Right? And there's a sense in which the university is still in a very primitive kind of form where it's doing everything in one place, and with the same people doing them. Whereas, in fact, they ought to divide the labor, right? That's the background theory to this view of the university, where the university looks very dysfunctional. And so what you want to then do is you want to stream these different functions and have them measured and evaluated in their different ways, and eventually have different people do them, essentially, so that even though, like at my university, which prides itself on being a very progressive kind of place in this kind of knowledge management sense, we are getting to a point where you have basically a two-tier system. You got your teachers, you got your researchers, you got separate contracts for them, separate promotion modes, separate modes of evaluation. And of course, after a while, some smart person is going to ask, why do we keep these people all in the same place? Why don't we just have two institutions instead? Why have one institution with these two radically different things going on if teaching and research diverge as much as that? Right, and from a knowledge management standpoint, that's fine, right? Because institutions come and go, right? And if they don't serve their functions adequately, you just design a new one. So the university may be an organization that has outlived its usefulness, and I think there's a sense in which knowledge management thinking really kind of puts you into that groove of thinking along those lines. So that the sorts of things that were the hallmark of the modern university, right, that were seen, that Humboldt and others presented as being very progressive, are now being portrayed as pathological. Okay, and academics themselves do not help matters. Because as you know, academics here, right, academics hate universities, right? Universities are the things that get in the way of your doing your work, right? All those deans and administrators and paper pushers, I haven't even talked about students yet. But the point is that the university is seen, is very much something that's othered from the academic life. And you see, that's music to the ears of the knowledge manager. Right, because that's a sign of dysfunctionality right there, where people are so alienated from the institution. So you got to take this institution apart, right? And so you start, hot desking people. In other words, you start really separating people out from the place of the university. You make it as easy as possible for people not to have to go in. You turn the university into sort of glorified management training seminar center, and the classrooms are just being used, a few hours of every day in the weekdays, right? And so gradually this is part of the evolution of removing any kind of sense that there is a kind of stable place that is the embodiment of an idea. Which is, of course, what the whole idea of the campus, university was supposed to be, of these dedicated buildings with these dedicated people in them, right, that are upholding some kind of idea. But that's all gradually disappearing. And as the new universities get constructed and new parts of universities get constructed, what do you find? Well, most of the time, it's designed for cars, right, so as to make easy entry and exit. Right, which shows obviously you don't want to spend a lot of time in this place, right? So this is part of what's going on. So in a way, we're seeing through the knowledge management culture, right? The universities gradually kind of losing their salience as an idea, largely as their physical spaces get reconfigured, and also, you know, as they try to sort of take into account the surface complaints that academics themselves make about universities. Okay, so now I think this is all very dangerous in a way, because, and this in a way relates to the issue of interdisciplinarity, because interdisciplinarity is a two-edged sword here. And I want to move on to talk about that, but first I'm going to open, at this point, having spoken for about 30 minutes, I'm going to open it up to any kinds of issues people want to raise, because I'm going to switch gears a little bit, but I want to see where we are now. Come on, you want to bring something up?
Is knowledge management, is that the villain at the moment?
Is it what?
The villain at the moment, or the enemy, knowledge management.
Is it the real enemy? No, it's, well, I mean, I think
put a label on that, what you're describing, is that knowledge management?
Well, look, I think the sense in which, I think knowledge management should be thought of as a sort of ideological enemy, in the sense that knowledge management really flattens whatever distinction universities had as knowledge-producing institutions, right? Because one of the premises of knowledge management is kind of everything produces knowledge, right? And as soon as you start with that premise, then the distinctiveness of the university gets called into question, because you've sort of flattened out what knowledge is. Because, you know, in a classical way of thinking about knowledge production, right, and I don't know if people still, if anyone believes this anymore, but when I was a kid, right, this is what we were taught, right, that in a sense academics produced knowledge and then it got applied or it got distributed, right? So there was a kind of a chain of command with regard to knowledge. That at least, you know, if not at the actual production level, at least at the level of legitimation, nothing really counted as knowledge unless there was a degree program devoted to it or there was some academics working on it or something like that. But that's not so clear anymore, right? And in a sense, the knowledge management culture contributes to that flattening, where the universities, let alone not having a monopoly on the production of knowledge, don't even have a monopoly on the legitimation of knowledge. Okay? And so, you know, insofar as one's defending the university, and I realize there may be people in this room who don't want to defend the university and who actually agree with the knowledge management diagnosis, and maybe we should take a show of hands, but the point is that if you do believe the university is something worth defending as a distinctive institution, even if it has to be reconfigured in some significant way, the knowledge management culture is the enemy. I mean, it's a bit like utilitarianism with regard to values. Right? If you understand, in moral theory, right, utilitarianism, you know, as Jeremy Bentham says, Pushpin is as good as poetry, right? Pushpin being this kid's game, is as good as poetry in terms of the value if people are afforded the same amount of pleasure from it. Well, in a sense, knowledge management has that attitude toward knowledge, right? I mean, if there are people out there to buy the knowledge, it doesn't matter who the people are. Right? You just have to find your client base, and there you go. Right? So it's like that, you see. And universities are dedicated to the idea that there is some sense in which one could talk about a qualitative difference with regard to knowledge. So that's why it is a very... I mean, you know, I write a book on this topic... And if you, I don't know if any of you have read it, but the book is not entirely negative. Okay? I mean, I do think, though, that it is, because I do think knowledge management does provide a certain way of becoming critically self-reflexive as an academic, because I think academics sometimes have a very hard time imagining how someone else who might have an interest in knowledge see what they're doing. And some other, you know, putting themselves in some other frame. And I think knowledge management literature is really good at doing that. So, for example, you know, when I read this book, Intellectual Capital, which says, you know, McDonald's is a smart organization. Low human capital, high structural capital. Get a bunch of idiots, but organize them well. Now, that is management genius, right? Dumb organization is a university, the exact opposite of McDonald's. High intellectual capital, low structural capital, because you got very smart people and you don't know what the hell they're doing. Okay? Now, when I read that, I said, my God, now that's an interesting spin on what, on you know, what's good and bad in this society, right? Where McDonald's comes on top, right? And where universities come in the bottom, from the standpoint of knowledge, okay? And what they're talking, and, you know, what specifically is being talked about in this comparison, right, is management knowledge, right? Where the management genius is in being able to run a place like McDonald's, where people can be virtually illiterate, and you make billions of hamburgers. Whereas university is a complete failure, right? There's no management involved there at all. There are a lot of very smart people, but no one's minding them. No one's organizing them. Okay? Now, that's a very, you know, when I first read that, you know, it was amazing. I have to say, I thought, wow, that really does put it, and it was the sort of thing that really caused me to get more heavily involved in the political economy of knowledge production, to think about the university as a viable organization. It was that kind of thing. And I think that's the value of reading this knowledge management literature, because the people who write this stuff do not have mystified views about universities. They really do see universities as dysfunctional and a waste of money and all this. You know, this is not just something dumb politicians say, okay? Yeah.
To follow up this, I think, you know, you have a very Humboldtian view of what is the university and what should be the university. For me, you know, when I came from a university in England to this school here, it was a traumatic experience, you know, because this school here is a professional school that educates. We serve the companies. This is a business school that makes business.
Yes.
Okay. So what is your view about this? You know that there is all this talk. We had a week ago Henry Etzkovich talking about the rise of the entrepreneurial university and MIT and Stanford and there, you know, all this stuff. What do you stand about?
Well, first of all, I think these stories about MIT and Stanford, when you look at the American models, they're very misleading, because these American models, it isn't just about this entrepreneurial stuff. These universities are very solid on their own terms already. Okay, I mean, they typically have large endowments. They typically, you know, have quite a lot of autonomy, and they're just sort of increasing their power by having all this additional entrepreneurial stuff. It's a different situation when you have a school that, as it were, was founded to be entrepreneurial. Right, then there's a different issue about what the ethos of a place like that is, and what's the point of having it around. I mean, a couple of points about business schools in particular. One is, it's a two-way street, okay? You've been stressing so far, and I definitely agree with you on this, the degree to which a professional school, a business school, is always being driven by the client base, and the curriculum and everything has to be oriented that way, and the research has to be oriented that way. I have no doubt about that. But there was a very interesting thing that did happen in Britain in the 1980s when Thatcher was in power, because those of you who were living there at the time, it was very difficult to get academic promotion through the normal academic disciplines, and that the only sector of the university that really grew were business schools, and that was because of the first flush of neoliberalism and so forth. That was really where all the government support was going, was to expand the business schools. And one of the consequences of that was that a lot of the traditionally academically trained people who couldn't get promoted within, you know, whatever, departments of history or something, or sociology, right, moved into business schools and are now professors in business schools, my own included, right? And certain journals got founded in the back of all this. Accounting Organizations and Society, for example. You know, all this kind of neo-Foucauldian stuff. You know, where do you suppose that came from? Well, that actually came from a labor market pressure, right? Where it was impossible to get promoted through the normal academic disciplines in the 1980s in Britain. And these people move into the business schools. They now have the top professorships, and they're often very much pushing this interdisciplinary research. Because one of the positive features about a professional school is that it's not very discipline bound in the traditional sense, right? Because it's really concerned about a practice, a field that in a way can be gotten at through many different disciplinary perspectives. And this is kind of what happened in the 1980s as these people shifted over. So you actually do have a lot of intellectually interesting activity happening in business schools because, you know, that the sort of downstream effects of that. So it's a two-way street. It's kind of interesting in a way. But I agree, there's a real tension there. But in some of the larger, more academically prominent business schools, they're very strong, you know, very strong interdisciplinary programs, but typically because the people there, you know, are people who have their grounding in sort of traditional academic disciplines and are moving into this different environment.
Yes, and this is, I think, you know, the other... I was looking at your book yesterday, and you were talking about Kuhn and incommensurability, the idea to participate in the old and the new and talk the language and all this. And this is very important, I think, for the business school. I know some of the people here, they are in business schools, and I imagine they have trained as sociologists or this kind of other disciplines that, you know, they belong to the old Humboldtian view.
Well, like Hans, for example.
Yes.
Yeah, God, you can't get more Humboldtian than that.
I got a question. It sounds like describing it as an external problem. We have these knowledge management people, but my sense is that a lot of professors are kind of disconnecting themselves from teaching, being saying that, you know, research, that's the only thing they want to do. And
yeah.
So
yeah.
It's kind of internal as well. And then
yes. No, and I think my point is that I think the knowledge management people can capitalize on that. You know, in other words, insofar as you've got academics who go around saying, I don't want to teach, I just want to do my own research, right? To a knowledge management person, that says, well, look, you know, this guy is clearly, you know, wants to do this thing which he does well, but he's being forced to do this other thing that he doesn't do well. That suggests that the jobs in this organization aren't being sorted out properly. Okay? And I think that that's... So, and yes, I do agree. But look, I will be the first one to tell you, I don't think academics know much about universities. I mean, I think this whole idea of understanding what a university is, what a university is for, why you would go to work in a university rather than work in a think tank or you know, work for a newspaper or, you know, work for some other knowledge-producing organization. I think academics really don't have a very good sense of this. I think it's often for them just the path of least resistance once they've gotten advanced degrees. Right, it's the most natural career path to make, but I don't think there's ever any really considered thought. You know, I mean, one would think. I mean, I don't want to go too far on this, but there is a part of me that says that, you know, academics ought to have to undergo some kind of examination or certification process before they're allowed to be practicing academics, other than just having a PhD in a subject. Okay, because I don't, you know, because to be a member of a university is more than just to be a specialist in a particular subject. And if what you think you are primarily is a specialist in a particular subject, it's very easy to get into the kind of mindset you're talking about, where you just want to do your own thing and not have be concerned with any of the public functions of the university, even teaching.
You so being fixed up. I mean, you have the external pressures, and you have those people, you know, working with that, not posing themselves.
Well, I think, you know, in terms of what a practical strategy, I think business schools or schools of education ought to actually have dedicated programs to train administrators in higher education, especially, you know, in other words, where they're learning about these kinds of issues. Because I think really what you need is leadership from the top on this, and that's what's totally lacking. You know, where you really need people who have a vision of the university, you know, and will be very concerned that it's presented in the right way and defended in the right way, and they're not just generic managers. You know, so I worry about, for example, this tendency of a lot of vice chancellors now to come from the private sector, having spent a lot of time in the private sector, and, you know, like, for example, a guy who recently retired from Imperial College who was responsible for the merger of Smith, Kline, and Glaxo, and the first thing he wants to do is to merge all the colleges in the University of London. And even though he fails, he puts the idea in everybody's head. And so we've had Manchester merge, okay? And you know, and this whole, you know, this kind of mentality, right, this is kind of where we're drifting at the moment. So I do think there's a sense in which, you know, that senior administrators in higher education ought to have some kind of specialized training or certification that they actually understand the kind of organization they're running when they're running a university. I mean, at a practical level, and I think there ought to be courses for that and so forth. And I even toy with the idea that even people who are going to hold professorships, there should be some evidence they actually know what a university is.
Then you need kind of policy changes as well. Because, you know,
sure.
People are...
Oh, no, and there needs to be more active lobbying that you know, even though there are all these, in the UK we've got all these interest groups for universities that are funded, you know, where the vice chancellors speak in one voice over certain matters, right? But they're never pushing this kind of point. They're always worried about, you know, the basic stuff, like whether they're going to get enough money next year from the government. That's usually what they're worried about, and they're willing to bend, you know, if they increase the amount of money. So they're not making ideological arguments. And what I'm talking about here, to a large extent, is an ideological argument about what a university's for.
May I ask, what do you think, which is the mission of the university on the basis of your argument? And then how do you evaluate the impact of the university in the society? Because it is true that today we are basically using the industrialized measure for assessing the value of the university. But then how would you...
I know.
Differently the value of the university.
I think this is, first of all, this is exactly the question that needs to be asked. Because I think a lot of people who share my analysis of the situation don't want to talk about metrics at all, right? For them, metrics are part of the problem as such. And I actually don't believe that. I actually believe, look, if the university is doing something, it should be measurable. It's just that we're using the wrong measures because we're not, you know, we forgot what a university is and we're modeling it on something else. That's kind of where I'm coming from on this. I think we need to show some way, first of all, in which research has impact on teaching. Because I think, in a way, that's the biggest problem with the metrics that we've got now. Namely, teaching and research are treated as radically different things. Okay? And so we need some way of showing the connection between the two. Now, one can talk about things like the way in which courses are improved over time, the way in which they change so that students are learning different things. One might look at that. But there's another aspect of this problem, and that is the one you alluded to. How do you judge the long-term effects, you know, that the university has impact? And I think that's very complicated. But I do think that it needs to be seen, you might say, kind of on the model of multiplier effects. Okay, so in other words, the kinds of things that are stimulated. So the student gets taught a certain new idea. Okay, the student might not necessarily become a frontline contributor to that idea in the research sense, but will apply the idea something else, some other place where it'll add value to that other practice. And these things have kind of knock-on effects over time. I mean, there was a study that was done where you look at the major concepts that are brought up in newspaper editorials, and you look at where are these concepts coming from, and you see there's some time lag of 5 to 10 years from what's being taught in university humanities departments. You know, now that's interesting. Seems to me that's a way in which you can start to show these kind of longitudinal effects of how things being taught in the university ends up making their way into society at large. I mean, I'll tell you right now, one easy way for universities to prove their significance is at the cultural level with regard to the media. I mean, in Britain, for example, if you look at the way in which, films and television commercials and all this stuff, you see postmodernism all over the place. I mean, in a sense, it's, you know, that is a real impact. The kinds of media realities that are being presented to people are downstream effects from university teaching and postmodernism. And I don't see why that shouldn't count, because that is part of what becomes sort of the wallpaper of our lives. And that is very much the direct product of people having studied, you know, the French post-structuralist thinkers and stuff like that. Okay, and I think we just need to be a little more creative about this kind of thing. And one of the problems I think at the moment is that we measure effects in too short-term a way, and in terms of wanting very particular kinds of products. So why are we concerned about patents? Not because patents are necessarily any good indicator of economic productivity or anything, but rather because they're easy to measure. Right? They're easy to measure. And the same thing with journal articles. Right? I mean, you know, what's the significance of these things? Isn't it? But they're measurable. And I think that's, in a way, we're very much caught up in that sort of mentality, where we basically just measure what is most easily measurable. And we need to be a little more creative about this. For example, I think the kinds of impacts that we ought to... So here's an example of a problem we've got. In the United Kingdom, we have these research assessment exercises every 4 to 5 years. Okay? Now, in that same 4 to 5 year period, you not only have to have done the work, but the work will have had to have had impact then. Now, what a screwy idea, right? So, you know, that's a big mistake right there. I mean, a smarter thing would be to think about impacts of things that happened before the 4 or 5 year period and see what those impacts are now. You see, at least that would be a start in the right direction, right? That would start to... You know, because at the moment, people are really being forced to think in terms of stuff that can have very immediate, short-term impact, make a big splash fast and then disappear by the next cycle. Because if something has its biggest impact in the next cycle, it doesn't get counted. It'll look like you had no impact. Okay, so there are a lot of these kinds of issues that need to be kind of sorted out. But at the moment... Well, you need lots of different kinds of expertises to bring to bear, right? You need the people who can define the indicators. You need the people who have a good kind of macro sense of how effects are distributed across society, the different kinds of effects that academic work has, you know, and put that into a kind of large composite picture. But I just don't see that. I don't see the will for that at the moment. I think people tend to want to solve these problems in the cheapest way.
Hi, I'm quite interested in your views about leadership in AG, and you've it's about digital energy, and I completely agree with you in the sense that leaders need to have vision, etc., because we've completed a big research looking at academic leadership in higher education institutions, where everybody says, yes, we need inspirational leaders, leaders with vision, etc. But at the same time, now, you lots of DVCs, pro-vice chancellors, vice chancellors, go through the leadership foundation, leadership development programs.
Yeah.
But when you ask them what the value of those programs were, they would normally say, well, the program wasn't as interesting as such, but what we got out of it is normally networks.
Yeah? Sure.
So, and they sort of, when they have difficult problems, they can always call the other person, the vice chancellor in another university or something like that. So whether, I'm wondering whether these kind of leadership development programs would work sort of in the HE context.
Oh.
Saying that we always compare leading academics as trying to herd cats.
Yes, right? Yes, that's right.
So if, I guess my question is, so what kind of elements do you think you would introduce in order to certify leaders in the HE context?
Well, you might say kind of a best practice approach. I would do it. I mean, I'm not sure how these... My department head at the moment is going through one of these leadership training things because she has aspirations for higher office. What I would, and this is on tape, what I would do is teach in terms of find examples of visionary higher education leaders. You know, and look at what was their context? What was the logic of their situation? What kinds of issues did they have to deal with? I mean, so for example, I'll tell you, Harvard University is an amazing place for academic leaders. And actually, the United States generally is a very good place because the American universities, even if they're state-funded, are quite institutionally autonomous. And there is this very long tradition of the university president thinking of themselves as something like a president in a real sense, a chief executive who in a way becomes the personification of the institution, right? Not merely to raise money, but in political arenas and so forth. And so you've got a whole lot of books written by these guys. I mean, this is one thing that's very striking, right? A lot of books written by these presidents of American universities, which many of which are not bad at all. Okay, and especially the ones from the Harvard people, Derek Bach, you know, James Bryan Conant, who was Thomas Kuhn's mentor in the 1940s. I mean, there are a lot of these really important guys who in a way had their eye on many different balls at once. I mean, they had the personnel issues about bringing in the best faculty. They had the resource issues about funding the university. They had the intellectual issues about what the university stands for. And they're managing all these things at once, right? And often with a lot of struggle and so forth. But there's a lot of success to be had there, and you know, and also to look at the difficulties. I mean, you know, just like when you send someone who goes to officer training in the military, right? You show them, you know, the great generals. How do they? What was their strategy and tactics in the decisive battles of the war? Well, I think you could do this for higher education leaders. You know, for presidents of universities. What kinds of challenges do they face? How do they rise to the occasion? I mean, there are a lot of good examples of that. You know, and even at a more systemic level, one of the things that I've been talking, sometimes when I give talks of this kind, I talk a bit about Friedrich Althoff, the Althoff system, right, which was basically this consolidation of the entire higher education sector in Germany with the unification in 1870, which over the course of a generation made Germany the number one scientific powerhouse in the world. And he had some very interesting ways of determining, you know, how you are able to arrange universities in a way that they can be internally competitive with each other, but at the same time the state can capture all of the benefits of that. A lot of very smart kinds of moves that really did a lot for Germany, and I think to a large extent has been kind of forgotten, because one problem I think we have is that the history of higher education is still for the most part a kind of institutional history in the most reductionist sense. Namely, you know, you're concerned about size of institutions and how many students and how much money they get. You know, so it's all very, very kind of workaday sociological stuff, right? And the whole personality dimension of this, the fact that there are some very significant people who with visions who actually had some imprint and made some moves that were important, that kind of gets lost. Because these people typically, you know, had already left their original discipline, so they're not captured within the histories of their own disciplines. You know, so even somebody like Humboldt, right? I mean, it's only in this context that we really talk about him, even though he was a very distinguished linguist and, you know, had all sorts of philosophical things going on. But I think that's the way you would do it. You would teach in terms of, sort of certain kind of great personalities, you know, and then say, what kinds of lessons can we learn? You know, and so really get these people who are in these courses to sort of try to reimagine themselves in those situations. That's what I would do. I mean, that kind of strategy does seem to work for officer training in the military. You know, and I don't see why that couldn't be applied to higher education.
Just one comment.
Yeah.
Listening to you now, I was thinking that probably we should distinguish the university as institution from academics as people that are animated by the fire of knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
What I want to say is that probably the university as an institution has to prove that it's creating some value, and then in this complex world as is part of the value chain. Academics, the real academics, and probably this is something that you were stressing implicitly, there are very few real academics today, and many professor or researcher that are part of the institution. But academics, the real one, still find in the university the only place where they can get the salary. So probably it would be useful to make this distinction between university as institution and the kind of value that we create in today's world from academics as people that create just knowledge that are animated by the curiosity, by some kind of mission or values.
Yes, but your higher education administrators have to be mindful of these latter people, these academics, because, you know, in other words, they have to realize the value of those people, and that has to be part of what they're defending. I mean, because otherwise those people will just not have a place at all. Okay, and that's, I think, one of the problems at the moment. I mean, you know, to give you one example, in my own department, we have an accounting system, as it were, by which one demonstrates one's research active. Now, you would have thought demonstrating one's research activity would be a matter of publishing stuff, right? That sounds reasonable, right? Actually, research activity is measured primarily in financial terms, in terms of what good grants you're bringing in, okay? Now, it seemed, you know, and that's called research active, okay? And this is just one small example of a lot of the sort of Orwellian transformation of the language that's taking place, where we're still talking a kind of academic discourse, but what the way it's being operationalized is really undercutting all of those kind of classical values. And the problem is the higher administrators are contributing to this process, right? They're contributing to this kind of reworking of the norms. I have a slide here. I mean, I'll show you a little bit later about what I call knowledge society newspeak. Okay, because I really believe that this kind of world, that this kind of neoliberal kind of management of universities we're entering into, it's diabolical because of the systematic way in which language is sort of reworked. So in a sense, you don't quite realize, unless you look closely, just how de-academicized university life has become. You know, but see, this is where you need your university administrators to be on top of this issue. They have to be. They shouldn't be contributing to it. They should be, you know, very much aware of it.
In fact, if you look at grants, you know, from probably a business point of view, stupid because we are doing, we're turning an input into an output. And even administrators understand that they have no reply to it.
Yeah, well, this is a problem, yeah. No, I agree.
Yeah, here I want to say something about the SP knowledge. Here we said knowledge is something about what is knowledge and how we know knowledge. And we believe that academia and university are the main place to create, to find new knowledge. But I think in this level, maybe that was true 100 years ago. University and academia are the main place to create, find new knowledge. But in these several decades, I think it's clear the commercial organizations are playing more and more important role in this process. Create more, maybe not more, but create more some important practical knowledge and also foundational knowledge. So how do you...
Well, I mean, let me even put the point more strongly, because I think one shouldn't be too sentimental about this. In fact, the only areas where universities have been the main producers of knowledge ever was in the humanities and social sciences. Never in the natural sciences were universities the primary producers. Okay, and certainly in the 20th century. Especially if you look at the interdisciplinary nature of the most distinctive developments, whether we're talking about molecular biology or artificial intelligence research or any of that kind of stuff, right? It's typically at least the funding, if not the actual grounds where the stuff happens, is outside the university, and then the university takes it on board. By the way, this is the point, if you've never read Lyotard's The Postmodern Condition, this is what that book's about. Okay, you say, well, you know, what is this postmodern condition thing he started? Well, it was about this point we're talking about right now. Namely, the whole idea of thinking that academics or the universities are the main producers of knowledge. In some sense, like this thing I was talking about earlier, where there's this central place where the knowledge comes from and then it gets distributed and other people pick it up, that's a complete myth, right? It's the ultimate meta-narrative, right, that Lyotard's talking about in that book. I don't know if you know, but you know, the postmodern condition was a report on the state of knowledge to the Higher Education Council of Quebec, right? That was what the context in which that book was written. And it's written like a report. So it's all about all these developments in the 20th century, where basically it's saying, you know, all the knowledge is coming from industry, essentially, or from the military, or, you know, from outside universities, essentially. And then the universities appropriated, okay? So grant your point. Historically, you're absolutely right. I do think where universities have been very distinctive has not been in the production of knowledge, but has been in legitimation and in distribution. And this is where the connection between research and teaching becomes very important. In fact, for me, the core of the university is not the research function, but it's the teaching function. Right? It's that translation of research into teaching. You know, in one of my books, maybe it's even the knowledge management book, which talks about the university, I talk about that the core of the university is the curriculum committee. Because the curriculum committee is the place where all these people who've done all this research get together and say, well, what is it about the research that I do that people other than specialists ought to find out about? Right, so if I'm putting together a curriculum for a major, an undergraduate major in a subject, right, most of the students who take that major will not be working in the specific area that I know something about, but I have some reason to think they should know something about it. Well, what should they know about it? And when should they know about it? How should we put in with the rest of the stuff they should learn? Okay, that's what the universities do very distinctively. Right, they convert knowledge into a public good in that sense. Because they take all of this research, which otherwise would be quite specialist, quite esoteric, move in quite different circles, right, and combine it, integrate it into things like curricula. You know, in a sense, the curriculum is the main product of the university. Because that's where the knowledge is integrated. So when you pull out a course outline, that's the main product of the university. Because you see then all the little bits of knowledge from stuff people have produced, all in one place to be delivered to students. Okay, and that's what universities have been consistently good at, and that's something only they do. Nobody else really has an interest in doing that. Vocational training courses have interest in training people in very specific skills for specific job markets, and they do that well, right? And then you've got your science parks, which have these client bases for the intellectual products they come up with, and they work with that. But in terms of what I'm talking about here, where you're taking knowledge from many different sources and you're putting it together in a curriculum that will then be distributed to students at large, whoever happens to major in the subject, that is very distinctively the university. So that's a very specific kind of function. I think an incredibly important function, but quite a specific function, and it is one that is always neglected. Right? It's very much neglected, but it seems to me that's... So you want to look at the point where research gets translated into teaching. That's why curriculum is important. That would be... But I grant your... You know, this point about that universities haven't been the main producers of knowledge. It's true. It's true. Other issues? I can plow ahead, but... I don't want to leave anyone out here.
Perhaps we should bring in Pierre, who came late, but he wanted to be here for listening to what you say. I think the discussion between, you know, what you said, research and teaching, and how research is feeding into teaching and so on, in France is very interesting for me, and I'm sure Pierre may tell us more about this, because there is the separation there was between the CNRS and the university, but now it's changing again, isn't it?
It's changing slowly.
Into metrics again.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, one of the. I don't know if you run across this kind of problem, but in the original Humboldtian model, one of the reasons why the curriculum was so important, and this comes out very much in the German idealist philosophers, is that the point of teaching wasn't to teach for skills at all, but was to teach for citizenship. Right, and so part of what the curriculum was forging wasn't just knowledge of a particular subject, but, you know, how to behave as a sort of citizen, you know, understanding that you're going to be part of the next generation's leaders. And the assumption is, you know, was from an economic standpoint that things would be very dynamic, that it didn't make sense to just sort of train people very narrowly, that what you wanted were people who were quite general and could quite move in what was seen to be a very changing kind of society. I mean, here I think it's very important that the whole German initiative of starting the university in the 19th century was a catch-up strategy, right, where Germany saw itself as being behind. And so the idea was to have, as it were, school people so that they can become more advanced and be more flexible and, you know, able to sort of move into, you know, the kind of the new world that they were entering into. And you see, that kind of context of citizenship, which was associated with the nation-building project, that's kind of disappeared too, right? Because as the nation state becomes less salient as an entity, then the point of what exactly are you educating people for? What is this citizenship, right? And to certain, some people try to introduce the idea of global citizenship as a kind of replacement notion, but it's very hard. So far, that hasn't had all that much purchase. But you see, that's one of the things that originally made this idea of the translation of research into teaching compelling. Namely, you're trying to, you know, kind of create a kind of full person who can function, you know, as a full participating member in the society. And it was in that context, by the way, that philosophy became the leading discipline in the university. So I think that's a very important point, because it's very easy for us to think about philosophy as the most important, you know, as the original discipline from which all the other disciplines came. But that image of philosophy is a 19th century image, and it's the one that you find from the German idealists, okay? Because prior to that point, if you think about how universities were operating, right, they were primarily professional schools. And so that somebody like Kant, for example, you know, Kant wrote a very famous essay called The Strife of the Faculties, where he's basically defending philosophy as against theology, as against medicine, as against law, okay? And quite clearly the context of that, and Kant's writing before Humboldt, right, is that philosophy's struggling to kind of assert itself as a field because it doesn't have any practical value. Okay, but once the modern university gets established with Humboldt, that all changes. Philosophy becomes the foundational subject from which all the other disciplines then develop. And so, you know, when people like Hegel and Fichte and Schelling write their great systematic philosophies, what they are basically are meta-curricula, right? They're second-order curricula. They're basically describing how all the bodies of knowledge relate to each other. That's what all their books are about, right? They tell you how all the bodies of knowledge relate to each other under some very fundamental philosophical ideas. And that was meant for university consumption, right? And that's when you start to get this idea of the professor of philosophy. Because if you think, you know, Kant was a professor of philosophy too, but he's really the first one. All these other guys who were philosophers before him, for the most part, were not academics. Yeah.
I can see that there are lots of pressures for dividing research from teaching, which may be our aim itself. But can you really separate research from teaching?
Easy, it happens all the time.
Well, most research is done collaboratively. Typically, research at universities is done within school frameworks. Typically, professors have students who are working researchers with them. And often, the output of the knowledge and research is created within a collaborative environment, which then becomes more integrated.
That's the wishful part.
Yeah. Now, yeah. I'm saying this not because I'm seeking to find a weakness in the argument, because I'm enjoying where the argument's developing, but recognizing that it's not necessarily the case that researchers are independent, isolated, autonomous.
Oh yes, no doubt about it. I'm not sure we disagree, except I don't think this collaborative stuff gets very far after a while. I think the collaborative stuff, I mean, if your idea of teaching is research training, I mean, that's not the original idea of teaching that we're talking about here. We're talking about teaching research to people who are not themselves going to be researchers. Right? It's not teaching as research training. Okay, there's a difference between those two. And that's why I think sometimes a lot of this collaborative talk is a little slippery, because in a sense it tries to make a not-so-hot situation look better than it really is. I mean, really, what you've described is actually, you make it sound like there's a lot of stuff going on, but actually it's much more restricted on the ground. You're basically talking about a professor with some PhD students, right, and some clients who are working together in some project, and then you say it has some other kinds of effects. Well, maybe, but this is certainly not the kind of systematic translation of research into teaching, into public knowledge that universities historically were about. Now, you're right that you need institutions in place to do that, and I think that that's a very important point. Namely, this stuff doesn't happen spontaneously, okay? That you actually need to have dedicated institutions in place that actually encourage the translation of research into teaching in this larger public sense, because otherwise I think the teaching will just be at the level you're talking about, where it's just research training. I mean, and I think that's very restricted at the end of the day, even though I realize it's very valorized these days. It's very restricted. Yeah.
Well, I look after research in business management at Manchester Met, Richard. And a lot of people here have said that they would like more time for research. And something that I have to do is dissuade early career researchers, newly doctoral people, from wanting to do a module on their passion. You know, they want to do an undergraduate module or a master's module on new public management or tourism marketing. And I said, don't, but I've just done a doctorate on it. Yes, but what you're actually going to do is fill your time with undergraduate teaching. I think one of the most useful things for teaching is the insight and the little stories you get as part to integrate into your teaching, and the wider reading that you get. But I think it's a feature of new universities in the UK that they're obsessed with this, how does your research inform teaching?
Yeah.
It doesn't really, does it? It's part of the paradigm of thing. There's not that direct relationship that we seem to be obsessed with.
Well, I mean, there are a lot of, well, yeah, that the UK issue is very complicated because, well, first of all, one reason, there are several reasons why research doesn't inform teaching. One of them is that basically they're not encouraged to be the same at all. So, for example, like, let's say myself, the teaching I would do in a given year, and I don't come from a new university, is determined by what is the student demand. You know, so you have a certain number of courses, you have a certain number of students subscribed to them, and that's, as it were, the bottom line, and then you figure out who's going to teach them. It's as straightforward as that. And then you try to match people's expertise to those courses that have to be taught, because it's very much student-driven in that sense. Now, I can say that for the last 5 years, that what it has meant is that I have done maybe one course that actually was related to anything I do research in. My primary teaching is in sociology of law, and most recently in media. Okay, and so there's that sense, because the two markets, the market for research and the market for teaching, are so segregated that it's quite common, you know, not to have these two things relate to each other. I mean, I think one reason why people like this research-led teaching thing is it's somehow meant to be a way of making it easier for you to incorporate your research into your normal teaching duties, okay, and to maybe get students interested in what you're doing and so forth. But it's a very mixed bag what the consequences of that is, and quite limited in its application, I think. So, do you want me to go on? I'll go on. Okay, let's see what we should do here. Okay, let me do a little switching around here for a moment. Let me see. I'm not the world's greatest PowerPoint person. Can you help me for a minute?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Can you get me to, where do I want to go? I'll go here. Maybe I want to go here?
Yeah.
Yeah, there you go. Let's look at this. Oh, I gotta make this big. Oh, this is not too good. Can you see? Yeah, you can see that. You can see that? Is that right? All right. Okay. I was talking to you a few minutes ago about, this is the mode speak. You guys know about mode one, mode two knowledge production? Good. I hope so. It's been around forever now. So this comes from the new production of knowledge book, Gibbons et al., 1994, a year that shall live in infamy. This is mode speak, knowledge society newspeak. Now, on the left column here, these are all phrases from this book. As you know, this book has a glossary, among other things, so you can learn the lingo. And what I want to do here is I want to just briefly go through what, and maybe some of you will find this controversial, but what I want to do is I want to go through what this mode speak amounts to in terms of the way in which we talk about stuff today. So look at it, in the very top line here, I got codified versus tacit knowledge, okay? Now the interesting thing about codified tacit knowledge distinction, this is a term that very often is associated with Michael Polanyi, you may know, a philosopher, originally a chemist, a philosopher of science, who is very much into this idea that most of the operative knowledge in science is not knowledge that's written down, but is knowledge that's gotten through apprenticeship and practice, and can only be transmitted through practice, and not through reading or talking or any of those things. Very often, the valorization of tacit knowledge... What I got here in these other two columns, by the way, is the first one is kind of the positive gloss one might give to mode speak. In other words, what you might think it means if you didn't realize what they really have in mind. You know, in other words, the good side of it. And then the second, this column here, is really what it means, as it were, the neoliberal demystification of what mode speak is about. So very often when one talks about the codified tacit knowledge distinction, one talks about it as if it were a kind of a performance competence distinction. That's to say that tacit knowledge is this kind of fount from which all of our intellectual life comes from. And in a sense, when we speak or write about something, we're only capturing it in a very kind of abstract way. We're not really capturing the fullness of the experience. But in fact, in the knowledge management literature, it really corresponds to something more like a fixed versus variable capital distinction. And that is to say, the tacit knowledge becomes the stuff that is changeable, okay, in the organization, the sort of thing that in principle you're trying to nail down. Okay, so in other words, from a knowledge management standpoint, tacit knowledge becomes kind of a problem in a way, because when the employee leaves, the knowledge goes with him. Okay, and so as a result, you got to somehow try to nail it down some way. And so the whole idea of having things like knowledge engineering systems and so forth, where you try to, as much as possible, computerize and in other ways capture the knowledge so that the people can disappear and you still have the knowledge. Okay, so tacit knowledge, rather than being seen as sort of a wellspring of creativity, becomes kind of a problem for management to be captured in some way. Second is context of application. Now, this we talked about a little bit earlier, because context of application originally comes from a language in which you think about basic research being created and then being applied. So there's a kind of order that's implied, right? But in fact, context of application means, in practice, client-centered research. In fact, mode 2 research is very much client-centered research, in that the client is calling the shots as to the ends of the research. And here I think it's really important that the mode 1, mode 2 knowledge production be understood. You might say, but mode 1 knowledge production is very much supply-driven knowledge production, as opposed to demand-driven, which is mode 2. So a good way of thinking about mode 1 knowledge production is something like a Kuhnian paradigm. Okay, so Kuhn has this idea, right, that science develops by having a paradigm, where a paradigm is some theory and method that then sets out what are appropriate problems to work with, right? And these problems are defined in very technical, very specialized terms, and that's how the knowledge develops. It's very much developed from the knowledge producer side. So they call the shots, they define the terms, they determine what the good problems are, and then once those problems are solved, then you might think of applying the results. What's sometimes called a linear model of science policy is of this kind, okay? But mode 2, of course, thinks about this from the client side. In other words, that it's not that the academics or the scientists are driving the knowledge production process, but rather it's the client who says, well, we need this problem solved. And then the knowledge resources are organized. And the knowledge resources can come from many different disciplines. So in that sense, client-centered research is always already interdisciplinary. It's very indifferent to disciplinary boundaries as long as it contributes to a solution to the problem. So that's a completely different way of looking at what the context of application is. Globalization. Now that's an interesting phrase. What does globalization mean? Okay. In the old days, when we talked about globalization, before globalization was a word, if you asked somebody what globalization meant, one would have said universalization. That's to say, the idea that there are common standards, common knowledge, right? That would have been the understanding of globalization that one would have had before we had a word globalization. But once we got this word globalization, it starts to mean something different. It starts to imply sort of specialization, okay? And what I mean by that is the idea that things have different functions in different places depending where they are in the knowledge system. So there's no expectation that everything, you know, that all parts of the knowledge system all over the world are doing the same thing, that all universities have the same departments or the same courses or anything, but rather there is specialization and interdependency. Okay, so it's as we're taking the knowledge system and imagining it as being subject to a kind of global division of labor. It's something closer to that. Heterogeneity. This is a very popular word, heterogeneity. Everything's heterogeneous, right? And heterogeneous is always presented as good. Okay. And of course, if what heterogeneity means is anti-homogeneity, in other words, we don't just want, you know, we don't want everything to be uniform or the same, that's fine. The problem is heterogeneity often means anti-autonomy. Okay, and I want to draw a distinction here. I don't know if you know in Kant's ethics, there's a distinction. The opposite of autonomy in Kant is heteronomy. Okay, so autonomy. When we talk about autonomy in ethics, and the same thing in knowledge production, by autonomy what we mean is that the ends are self-legislated. In other words, I choose what I want to do. Right? I am the one. I'm the one who sets my own agenda. And it's according to that I then judge my progress and so forth. So, for example, when we talk about a Kuhnian paradigm, right, knowledge is autonomous because the scientists set up the theories, set up the methods, they set up the problems, then they solve the problems, and they decide whether they've solved the problems. So it's autonomous. That's what we mean by autonomous in that sense. You don't talk about clients, you don't talk about external stuff, you just talk about the knowledge producers themselves setting their own agendas and making progress by that agenda. That's autonomy. Heteronomy is the exact opposite. It's where you're driven from the outside. Right, where you're, the context in which Kant talked about this, right, was that the Kant believed that the only way in which you ever knew you were really being ethical was when you were actively resisting your natural impulse. Right, because your natural impulses, what you would do to get pleasure, what you would do as the path of least resistance, that kind of way in which we often go through life, that's not ethical for Kant. Right, that's very much succumbing to animal nature, and he imagines animal nature as heteronomous, right, where animals are just always just being driven by their passions every which way, and they have no focus. Okay, and so the only way in which you do know you have this focus and this autonomy is if you resist that. So and how does science symbolize that? Well, in a sense, this is what technical language is all about, right? The artificiality of science is, in a way, a mark of its autonomy. Right? Because, the scientific theories, the abstract mathematical language, all of that in a way resists common sense understanding. There's a sense in which, in order to participate in this process of doing science, you have to undergo a certain kind of change of mind. This is what disciplining is all about, right? Right? And then you undertake that discipline, and then you think of the world in that way, and you're able to resist all the alternative ways of thinking about the world that's out there. Right, so you're a physicist working in the lab in a very specialized problem, and you work hard, and you're not swayed by anything happening outside of that. That's autonomy. Okay? I mean, I do think this is a very... Because people, the word autonomy gets bandied around and all the rest. I think it's very important to get a sense of what we're really talking about here. And so the artificiality of knowledge production is one of the marks of autonomy. That's very important, I think. Now, the problem is that when one talks about heterogeneity of knowledge production, one really means heteronomy. Okay, in other words, that we've got knowledge that in a way shows its value by the various sorts of demands it can satisfy. So it's client-driven, and there are lots of clients, and they're all driving you in the different directions. And so when you see, how do you know knowledge producers are heteronomous? Take a look at their CVs. If their entire research career is defined in terms of the grants they got, okay, and they go from one thing to another, and the only thing that unifies them perhaps is some kind of methods that they carry over, right, which are common to the grants, but the topics are radically different. Now that's heteronomy. That's heteronomy, okay? Whereas autonomy would be someone who, gets a PhD in a subject, right, stays in the subject, publishes in the subject, makes contributions to the subject, in spite of everything else happening in the world. That's autonomy. Okay, so, and I think, we need to have a very vivid sense of this here, because it is tied with a certain kind, there is an ethics to behind, an ethical vision behind this. And of course, one of the consequences, one of the things that Kant was trying to do, right, was Kant wasn't just trying to, make a distinction, in terms of ethics, but he was actually trying to define what makes us human beings. Okay, because what makes us human beings is that we have the capacity for autonomy. Animals don't. Okay? And in a sense, universities as places for molding the human being. And again, you go back to that classical German ideal of the university, right? The Bildung. Right? Bildung, German, right, it's kind of like this edification, right? Where you become a human. Human is something you have to be trained to become. It's not like something you're born with. You're born Homo sapiens, but you become a human through education. Right, that kind of self-training. Okay, well, this is kind of this is kind of what knowledge is supposed to provide in the sort of classical sense. And it's what's being removed now through ideas of heterogeneity. Okay, so, I mean, you may recall that the title of this talk that I gave was Humanity is an Interdisciplinary Project. And one of the things that I'm increasingly struck by as I look at the history of the university is the extent to which, right, when we talk about the curriculum being the core of the university, where the translation of research into teaching takes place, that in that what makes sense of this whole project is the idea that you're trying to systematically construct human beings, that there's an issue about humanity that in a sense is the ultimate product of the university, and that there's a sense in which you really can't be a full human being unless you've passed through this process. This was certainly part of the German idealist thing. And so when you look at the kinds of criticisms that you do start to get, you know, because the Germans are positioning themselves not only against the French, who are the direct competitors, but also against the British, okay, one of the big criticisms of the British is that, you know, these people think like animals, right? They're just swayed by the passions, right? And they reduce everything to sensation, and they don't have any kind of higher sense of being. Right, and this was the main critique of utilitarianism, was that it kept people at a subhuman level. You know, maybe very clever people, but at a subhuman level. And so you needed training to get to this level that the university would provide, and that would enable you to be autonomous, to be able to resist, let's say, the lure of money. Right? And to be able to do something on principle. You know, which in principle often meant for the state. Right? I'm laying all this stuff out because these are themes that are very much part of our, you know, might say modern consciousness here. It's not just about universities. It's about a lot deeper things about who we are. Okay. Now, you may know that from some of this mode to knowledge production literature, we get this redefinition of the university as an agora, forum. You know, Helga Novotny pushes this idea. What are we talking about here? We're talking about this space in Athens, which would be used as a marketplace and would also be used as a place for political discussion. Right? So it was a very flexible space. Right? Now, this is meant to be an idea for the university in the postmodern era. Okay? You might translate this to glorified car park. Right? Where the university gets emptied of an idea, but it retains a multi-purpose space. Right? That's maybe a conference center, you know? Like in my university, which in the weekends uses all the classrooms for conferences, maybe your university does this as well, right? That's very much in this mold, right? Where in a sense, it's a multi-purpose space, just like the original Agora was, okay? And this is an ideal being presented for the university. So the university isn't a knowledge unifier anymore, it's a knowledge advertiser. It becomes a place where people put up their wares, you know? Teachers will be teaching stuff to students one day, the next day there'll be a conference going on, people talking about other things, but the university itself has no content of its own except as a place to provide a space for the transaction of other people's ideas. The university itself has no ideas of its own, it's just a space. And this is meant to be a good thing. Then we get this phrase, the informatization of society, okay? And the interesting thing here is that, you know, you might think this means that knowledge mediates social relations, that in a sense people, you know, are more informed in the kinds of activities they engage in and so forth. But no, in fact, when we talk about informatization, typically what we're talking about are forms of knowledge that we can identify alienated from individuals. So we talk about, let's say, the IT things that people use. We talk about those means, we focus on those means, and we reduce individuals to users of those means. And we have knowledge industries. Now, this goes back to the point about knowledge management, right? In the old days, right, this would be seen as something where the university is privileged, but not anymore. In other words, the stress of the phrase knowledge industry gets shifted from the knowledge part to the industries part. Right, and there are lots of industries around, and universities are just one of them. And the same can be said also of this one, the massification of higher education. Okay, so what does that mean exactly? Now, you might say, well, God, now that everybody has to go to university, that means knowledge is being added to more people's lives. Well, no, actually what happens is that the knowledge that's being added matters less.
because everyone's got it. Okay? Pluralization of elites. Now, what does this mean? Pluralization, does this mean that knowledge workers are respected? Or does it just mean that they are modularized? In other words, you have more people working on more specialized areas, and in a sense, they are, in fact, have less autonomy than before. Now, this one down here, reflexivity, is one of my favorites, because everybody likes that word. And back in the old days, we used to talk about reflexivity as a critical notion, a notion where one is critical of the context in which one's operating. But nowadays, reflexivity very often means, especially in the Mode 2 literature, as adaptive to context, okay? Whereas in a way, one reflects on one's context to become more like it. Okay? Social capital, this one we've talked a little bit about. The point since social capital is such a popular phrase now, I think the point I'm always stressing is that it is not the same thing as a public good. That a public good is a really quite distinctive idea, which has to do with the idea that it would actually cost more to restrict access to it than to include people. Okay? And so in other words, that the value of having the good around is not merely exhausted by the people who contribute to its production. That to actually just limiting it to that would actually cost more to do. So in other words, it's to your benefit to have spillover effects and to allow those things free rein. Whereas now, social capital is something which seems to be, where the idea is you want to build as big networks as possible, but at the end of the day, it's the networks that capture the knowledge that's produced. The idea then is just to make them bigger. But it's still all captured within the network. There isn't a lot of discussion about a larger public that you might have responsibility for beyond the networks that produce the knowledge.
I think you now gave a good definition of a public good, which is not in accordance with teaching economics. But
what?
Your definition of a public good.
Actually, I get this from Samuelson.
We can talk about it later.
No, you don't recognize this as...
Well, I thought it was sort of a bit watered down version.
Okay. But don't you agree with the spirit of the point?
Yeah, well, it seems public good that it's not that you don't want to restrict it, you cannot restrict it.
Okay.
Which is a bit different.
Yeah, a bit different. But I think for purposes of this discussion, it's... Yeah.
No, there's so many terms here, and how you sort of change the meaning of a certain term.
Oh, no, I'm sorry, but I didn't think I changed it that much, actually. But maybe by your standards, I have.
Because you can talk to Samuelson, I think he's still alive.
Is he?
I think I'm not quite sure.
Okay. Social distribution of knowledge. Again, how does one think about this? You can imagine, so for example, in a university where we talk about knowledge being distributed across disciplines, right? As I was saying with the German idealist philosophers, the knowledge, all the different disciplines have some kind of place in the system, right? So there's a kind of a sense of a unit, an integrated unit, a bounded institution within which all the knowledge fits. It's not a matter of just sort of dispersed networks, which is kind of how we think about the social distribution of knowledge now, where there's no sense of boundary, where things just sort of spread in every direction, and so that even the whole idea of having a center of knowledge, because like I was saying with the rise of philosophy in the German university system, philosophy was kind of an anchor point for all knowledge, and all the other disciplines came out of that, right? And so there's this idea of there being a kind of bounded system, and one could talk about knowledge being distributed that way. But here we're talking about a dispersed network where, in a sense, knowledge just moves in all kinds of directions, and there is no center anymore. Then socially robust knowledge. Okay. Now, the socially robust knowledge, what do we mean by this? Well, again, in the old days, we talked about universally resilient knowledge, and what I mean by that is, knowledge that can withstand tests, like kind of a falsifiability criteria, something of that kind. Okay. But now, when we talk about socially robust knowledge, we talk more about locally plastic knowledge. And what I mean by that is knowledge that can be adapted to circumstance. where in a sense the issue is not that it remains reliable through lots of tests, but rather that it can be shaped and changed and molded to the situation as it demands. So it's kind of almost like a more rhetorical conception of knowledge. And people talk about knowledge being cultural in this sense. And then the idea of technology transfer. Again, this goes back to the point about academia legitimating industry. And this is a point about the 19th century and how natural sciences got into the university. Because, you know, as I was mentioning in response to one of the questions earlier, the natural sciences traditionally were not in the university, certainly not the experimental lab-based sciences were not in the university. But in the 19th century, people realizing that, in fact, there were lots of laboratories in industry and in technical polytechnics and so forth, that universities had to in some way capture the knowledge that was being produced in those settings. And how was the university going to do that? Well, the university would basically provide the overarching explanatory theories for this stuff. So in other words, if you're going to be an engineer, you've got to learn some physics. If you're going to be a medical doctor, you've got to learn some biology. Right? That basically being the idea. And so providing a scientific basis that legitimates, right, these otherwise applied or more technically oriented forms of knowledge. And in fact, this was the idea that in Britain, this was an idea that was pioneered by William Whewell at Cambridge. I don't know if you've run across him. He's the person who coined the word scientist in the English language in the 1830s as the name of a profession. Because, of course, people have always been doing science, but the whole idea that you have a dedicated profession for doing science that you would be paid for, a scientist, okay, that was his coinage. And what he introduced was the first natural science courses to do this kind of thing I've just been talking about. In other words, provide the covering, overarching theories that explain and legitimate, you know, engineering practice and other kinds of technological things to enable the university to be to sort of have significance during the Industrial Revolution, because there was this great concern that universities would end up losing their significance, because if you can't learn this important technical knowledge that is in fact driving the industry of the country, what good is a university? Okay, and so he was very much responsible for that. But what he succeeded in doing was to regain the advantage for the universities. So the universities came in as legitimator. But the situation that we're in now with the university is not really legitimating knowledge in industry, but is servicing it. Okay, and this whole idea of knowledge being client-centered, right, where in a sense industry is not interested in universities because of the great theories that they teach, but rather because they can provide certain kinds of deliverables. And in fact, one of the ways I think you see this is the degree to which industries try to influence the curriculum. You know, and in a sense, it's had in disciplines like physics, which are traditionally very high academic disciplines, there's been a lot of conflict between physics departments and, you know, potential employers in industry with regard to how the physics curriculum is constructed, because the physicists just study too focused, too narrowly in physics, and as a result, they don't get the kind of knowledge they need to actually be able to contribute to these larger interdisciplinary projects, okay? So when an industry responds that way to the physics curriculum, they're not thinking about physics as legitimating anything. They're thinking it basically, you know, as something to service their needs, and they wanted to make it as easy as possible for that knowledge to be imparted to their future employees. Okay, and then finally we get to transdisciplinarity. And transdisciplinarity, what exactly does this mean? Now you might think it means interdisciplinary, but interdisciplinary is not really what transdisciplinarity is about. Because interdisciplinarity implies you start with the disciplines, like I did in the beginning of my talk, and then as it were you see gaps that have to somehow be bridged. That whole story of talking about how you get interdisciplinarity is entirely supply-driven. That is to say, it is driven from the knowledge side. It is driven from the existence of disciplines, which then requires some kind of interaction between them. But transdisciplinarity is something that comes from the outside. Transdisciplinarity is where there are problems, right? And that, in a sense, the problems dictate the parameters within which solutions will be found. And then the question is, which disciplines get involved? A number of disciplines could be involved, right? But there is no attempt you know, at integration or anything, any long-term attempt at integration or anything like an interdisciplinary body of knowledge might do. If anything, disciplines appear as kind of obstacles to transdisciplinarity. They are not things to be bridged, but things to be overcome. Okay, and I think that's you know, that's why I think it's quite interesting that, you know, you've stressed the role of interdisciplinarity in this workshop, and I'm wondering, you know, whether that really is interdisciplinarity or whether it's code for transdisciplinarity, which, you know, in terms, which in turn would cast doubt on the value of disciplines altogether. Because I take transdisciplinarity to do that. A transdisciplinarity really says, well, look, knowledge is coming from somewhere else, and that disciplines are kind of obstacles to realizing that. So, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I don't know how you guys think of it, because interdisciplinarity is a brilliant idea, is a brilliant and critical idea vis-a-vis established disciplines. Okay, because in a sense it becomes part of the critical self-reflexive process of academia, where, you know, disciplines develop in a certain way and they have certain blind spots, and then you need interdisciplinary knowledge to bridge them. The problem comes when the motivation comes from the outside, where you say, well, we need knowledge for these kinds of purposes. I'll give you a good example. Biology, okay? If we have to look at a science that is very much in the vanguard in terms of public funding, public attention, significance, these days it's biology. In a way, biology has a status that physics had 20 years ago. Okay, but not all branches of biology. Now, this is the interesting point, right? The parts of biology that are in fact flourishing and doing incredibly well are the lab-based parts of biology that can feed best into pharmaceutical industry and other kinds of industrial ventures of that kind. Whereas other areas of biology, so the areas of biology, let's say Darwin was most familiar with, are kind of dying a slow death. Okay, right? There's not a lot of money for those areas. So if you look at, you know, so, you know, at one level you can say, well, biology is flourishing and so forth, but it isn't flourishing across the board, right? And the way in which the money is being attracted is very much in a transdisciplinary way, where in a sense what's driving it is not the scientific research agenda necessarily, in other words, not to integrate biology in all its various fields, but rather very specific kinds of client bases that, let's say, require drugs and treatments and stuff like that, which then grow certain branches of biology while other branches just sort of die. Okay? And that's a very transdisciplinary development. Now, if you contrast that with physics for a moment, where historically, when physics had its great growth period after World War II, it was largely state-based, state-driven, and was very much about promoting the body of knowledge as the vanguard of some sort of unified science. And that was the image that was being promoted. And whereas now, it's not like that at all. It's a much more diversified kind of place where certain areas are growing very strongly in biology, others not at all. Okay, and that's very much kind of the transdisciplinary makeup, because not if you really make knowledge into a market phenomenon, it does not follow that all the different branches of knowledge are going to benefit equally from this. Some will survive and some will die. And there's
I would argue biology should not be looked upon as one discipline. It is quite microdisciplinary in its view. And you're speaking about DNA, the molecular level of biology, which, you know, when you think about it, as more of a physics chemistry background.
Sure.
Itself.
No, that's true, methodologically speaking, but the methods aren't really driving this issue. I mean, what's driving the issue...
Concept, though, I mean, at the micro-molecular level, it's a completely different scenario to the main macro level of biology, which is much more humanistic and looking at...
No, I understand. But my point here... No, that's true, of course, but my point here is that there is not enough of an internal driver within biology as a discipline to try to put those things together.
It's not a discipline. Biology is not a discipline.
Well, that's easy to say now, of course, given the way it looks, but there was certainly a thought that it was a discipline at some point. And in fact, if you look at university departments, they very often have begun as departments of biology that then fragment in the kinds of ways that you're talking about. I mean, there's a very good example. A study was done, for example, in the Berkeley, University of California, Berkeley biology department, which, as you may know, over several years has gone through various funding regimes and so forth, with I think Novartis buying the molecular biology department or something there. But the point is that if you look at successive catalogs from Berkeley over the 20th century about the Department of Biology, what happens to that? It, you know, fragments and goes into many different spaces. And so now when you look at it, you know, it's quite easy to say, well, there's no one discipline here. It's just, you know, but that there was a point at which there was a discipline, and there were people who actually thought it was an important intellectual problem to integrate it. Right? I think that's the important point, right? I mean, when people thought, well, yes, there is this micro-macro split, there is this lab-field split, whatever, but that's an intellectual problem we ought to be solving by trying to bring the discipline together. But you're right, people don't think like that anymore. Okay, and I think that has a lot to do with the funding regime, where there's no incentive actually to push people to unify anything. Right? I mean, and this is where we get to the transdisciplinary moment in biology. Where you know, and this is where people talk about biology as the ultimate disunified science. It's also the most transdisciplinary science, it seems to me.
Some of this you describe, I think, as labels for computational biology has become playing ground for mathematicians.
Yes, that's right, that's right. Yeah, yeah. I mean, the thing, though, is whether... I have a kind of pet theory why certain areas like evolutionary theory at the moment have an enormous amount of public profile. And that is because it's very difficult to fund. I mean, you know, in, if we're talking just about the theory part, I mean, I'm not talking, you know, I'm not talking about molecular biology, I'm not talking about the pharmaceutical stuff, but the people who are most aligned with the kind of work that Darwin himself did, the field biologists, actually have a hard time getting funding, okay? And evolution is a very, you know, pushing evolution is actually a very good way of showing the larger cultural significance of this area of research and saying what its significance is to larger questions about the nature of life and reality and all the rest of it. And I think that's actually part of what's going on. And there have been some cases where some of the popular authors have been interviewed on British television and actually said, well, you know, when I couldn't get grants anymore, the only way in which I could, you know, make a living was doing this. And so, you know, I don't think, I mean, it might sound a bit nasty what I'm saying, but I do think I think there is a relationship between pushing this particular, you know, the way in which evolution has been pushed so much now and the difficulties in getting funding in the area. I mean, you don't have to write lots of books about molecular biology. You can get grants and just do the research, right? You don't have to do a lot of advertising. Yes, yes. I mean, see, I don't know what you guys make it. You know, when you people think about interdisciplinarity, what exactly you have in mind. But when I, you know, I've been pushing interdisciplinarity for a long time, but always as a way of kind of making the university self-critical by showing the limitations of disciplinary boundaries. Okay, and I think interdisciplinary research in its heyday, which I take to have been the 1960s and 70s, that was what it was about. Okay, so when we started getting things like, you know, women's studies, okay, and area studies, right, and various sorts of ethnic studies, right, the reason why all of those fields came into being was because the mainstream academic disciplines weren't taking into account these, you know, domains of reality very, very well. Okay, that was the context in which you had the great rise of interdisciplinarity within the universities in the post-war era. And very often, by the way, these things were being funded by the CIA and government agencies and so forth, you know, in terms of trying to find out about areas of the world that were not being traditionally covered by the humanities or social sciences. Okay, that was the context in which interdisciplinarity first came about. Now, we are in a somewhat different situation, it seems to me, where very often interdisciplinarity becomes a kind of Trojan horse for breaking down disciplines as a way of making universities more flexible. Right? So in a sense, you know, you kind of take the backbone of the university out, de-disciplinize it, essentially, when you interdisciplinize. And then that makes it much more receptive to this kind of transdisciplinary stuff.
I think that as business and management people, we are, by our nature, we grew up being multidisciplinary. Mm-hmm. I don't know if we are truly interdisciplinary, but we certainly have to be. Mm-hmm. Multidisciplinary, the obvious economics, sociology, psychology, it's just what we are. And the defence of academic domains by people in other faculties sometimes, I think, takes us by surprise. Yeah, because people are very defensive about their walls.
Yeah.
Whereas we embrace that. And do you think that's general in business schools or not?
Oh yeah, it's general. I mean, it's general. I mean, it's general. It's just what it indicates. I mean, as you know, in the British
context.
Yeah, but as you know, the ESRC ranks knowledge from business schools in the bottom of in terms of grant worthiness and stuff like that. So it has costs.
Well, we're not STEM subjects. That's why.
Well, I mean, no. But I mean, there is an issue about. And this was an issue that actually, you know, faced the field that I'm primarily associated with, science and technology studies, which is an interdisciplinary field. But then there's a question of what counts as standards of knowledge in the field. How do you know you got good knowledge in this area, right? Because, you know, if you're saying, well, we're drawing from all these different fields, what, you just draw on them as you please, right? I mean, is that how it works, or are there standards as to what counts as good or bad knowledge within interdisciplinary fields? You see. And that's always been the trouble of how they maintain themselves, is to actually figure out what the standards are. And that means you have to have typically some agreed set on what the problems are of the field. What is the problem in this interdisciplinary field that you are addressing? And what are appropriate theories and methods? And again, if what you're doing is mixing things from different fields, that can be a very tricky proposition. People will have quite different views about this. This is why interdisciplinary programs tend to be very volatile, right? I don't know if you've ever really see a business school in a way is a very cushy environment in a sense to operate in, because if you're in a normal academic faculty and you're trying to create interdisciplinary subject from these people with the high borders that you're talking about, that's a real problematic area. You look at the history of women's studies. You know, history of area studies. It's basically people from different disciplinary backgrounds imposing their standards on this common ground. And that's always been the thing that's made it very difficult to reproduce within the university. But if you're not unable to reproduce a form of knowledge within the university, it doesn't have any longevity necessarily. It just becomes, you know, one generation, one project based. And that's always been the real problem with interdisciplinary knowledge. If it doesn't become a discipline itself, how does it survive? You see, and I think one problem with mode two knowledge production is that mode two knowledge production doesn't consider this question very important. Mode two knowledge production isn't interested in reproduction of knowledge. It's introduced, you know, it's project based. You know, you get all the nodes in the network together for a little while, they collaborate on something, and then they disperse and go elsewhere and then collaborate on something else. And so the whole idea of reproducing a body of knowledge that's produced from this interdisciplinary thing doesn't really enter into the picture. You see, from a university, classical university standpoint, that's the problem with interdisciplinary knowledge, is how do you get standards that are sufficiently clear, you know, that you are able to reproduce the knowledge to another generation. And also, you know, one thing I used to stress a lot in my own writing about this was that really, that in a sense, interdisciplinary knowledge is very threatening to establish disciplinary boundaries, because in a sense, it really points out the inadequacies of what's already there. Right? I mean, and so you might say one of the goals of interdisciplinary knowledge is to reconfigure the disciplines, to perhaps get rid of some old disciplines. You see? And that's also another controversial point.
So how do new disciplines merge, according to you?
I could give you a couple of stories, okay? There is a story about, first of all, disciplines really start to grow, you know, they start to become very clearly identified as universities got larger and more expansive. I mean, so there's that story of just university expansion allowing disciplines to develop. But typically, the way they happen is you have something like a founding journal, right? So one of the things that an emerging discipline has to do is it has to establish some kind of normative machine, you might say, right? A way of constructing its standards.
You exemplified with AUS before, the Journal of Anthony Hopwood.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That could be an example of that.
Yeah.
Behavioral accounting.
Yeah, and you know, you and this then becomes kind of the gatekeeper. It establishes the standard for the this new kind of knowledge that's being produced. It becomes a kind of attractor. People who recognize themselves as being in that kind of discourse will start to publish there, right? So it's very often that's how you get how you attract. I mean, when I started Social Epistemology, the journal, it actually had that kind of effect. In that one of the ways in which you could prove that you're that this new field you founded wasn't just something you cooked up in your head is the fact that you get all these people sending their articles to it from all over the place. And then you begin to get a sense of who exactly is interested in this, and then people start to write books and refer to each other. I mean, there's a whole, you can do a kind of citation network analysis of how these things happen.
So there is a community of people who work together in the Kuhnian.
It only becomes Kuhnian if there's a clear paradigm. Right, a clear single paradigm, which I think is very hard to establish unless you got very strong institutional... You basically have to have resources concentrated in a certain way. I mean, so for example, I think the way in which you get something like physics becoming a paradigm in the way it is has a lot to do with the control exerted by the Royal Society in the early days in terms of what was counting as science and prohibiting certain kinds of discourses from being published in its proceedings. And then later on, when you start to get required, you know, national scientific textbooks, which you start to get in Germany in the late 19th century, I mean, all these concentration of resources ends up enabling something like a paradigm to come into being. I mean, because, yes, you can establish a community of readers and writers for a particular journal, but that will only that'll only get you so far. That'll get you kind of a kind of disciplinary presence, but it won't necessarily establish you as a kind of science in the strict sense. So, for example, social epistemology, there are a lot of different things that travel under the name that only partially overlap with each other. And that's pretty normal. That kind of phenomena is pretty normal. What's harder is to actually have a kind of common focus where you can say, we have done this in this discipline. It's been accomplished. Now we're going to move on to do the next thing. You see, that's a difficult thing to, if you think about it, it's a very hard thing to kind of tell a narrative like that, unless you've got concentration of resources.
Reflecting on my own experience, I think multiple memberships is the name of the game today.
Yes. No, well, that's true. As a survival strategy for individuals, yes. But what makes for a good survival strategy for individuals may not be great for institutions in the long term. Okay? I mean... Sure. I mean, you know, when you offer advice to students and so forth, of course, you know, you never know who's going to be your next employer, where you might want to be publishing next, whatever. You might be moving from many different research fields. But if everybody operates that way, it's, you know, we're definitely going to lose the disciplinary structure of the university and probably lose the distinctiveness of academic vis-a-vis other forms of knowledge. That's my guess. And I think one way you see that already is that among the multiple memberships that people have, right, is both being involved in academic projects and in non-academic projects. Right? People kind of moving between the realms. And in a sense, keeping it a live option all the time as to which realm they actually belong to. Now, you see, this is a real problem because, again, if you think about it from the reproduction side, how does the institution get reproduced under these circumstances when people think this way? When everybody's...
My feeling is that coming from technology, innovation, management, this is the name of the game, you know. Technology is not really, you know, an established discipline, information technology that I study, and so on. So this idea of studying how new forms of technology emerge, how this interacts with the management, the organization, the innovation literature, this demands this kind of what you call transdisciplinarity and so on, to have these different views from different...
Yes, there are two things here, right? You're right, of course. But I think the issue then becomes, how do you institutionalize this knowledge that you've come up with? Right, so it's one thing to say you need to be transdisciplinary in order to be able to understand all these things. Okay, now you've done that. Where is it being published? Who is it being taught to? In other words, how does it become part of the knowledge reproduction process? Because, and will it become part of the academic knowledge reproduction process? That's the issue.
Well, you know, with Jeff and Stephen and other people, we do try to published in established journals, in R&D management journal, for example. We do try to publish in our own journal.
Mm-hmm.
That we're creating.
Well, good.
So this is, the name of the game. It is the...
No, but okay, and there's nothing wrong with that, but there's a sense in which if you want this to have some real permanent impact, right, it's got to go beyond the level of the journals, and this is where is it in the curriculum, and, you know, that's the thing. It has to have that more institutionalization. Because, you know, journals come and go, and very often they're just sort of platforms for people, for particular people who happen to be associated with, and then once they disappear or disaggregate, the journal goes too. I mean, but if we're talking about, you know, a kind of a form of knowledge that lasts more than one generation. That's the thing, you see? I mean, and see, people, this is what tenure was all about back in the old days. When we used to have, when academics used to have tenure, right, there was a sense in which they could think about their research as lifelong projects, right? You know, and they don't have to be productive every 3 seconds, and they don't always have to be working on anything fashionable, but they could work autonomously, and they could think in the long term, and they could think about what is important about what I'm doing, and, you know, how do I want to transmit this to students, and so forth, and that's what they would be spending their lives doing. And there was, and so the time horizon of that kind of knowledge production gave whatever came out of it a certain kind of longevity, because it was designed for reproduction, you might say. This stuff's not designed for reproduction, it's designed for consumption. You know, you sort of do it, it has impact, and then you move on. That seems to be how people work these days.
Well, this is how business schools work, you know. I was the associate dean for research, and this is how we did it. You know, the idea was to manage this, was to manage the pipeline, the accreditations, this is how it works.
Sure.
It's a trade mill, and that's all, you know. This is, and it's thought-provoking what you say, you know, from the sociology of science point of view.
Well, you look at it this way, from my standpoint. What's thought-provoking provoking for me is the fact that business schools are now being seen as models for universities. That's thought-provoking, okay? So in other words, what you're talking about, right, I mean, see, because I kind of, you know, the spirit of what you're saying is, you know, but this is what we do in business schools. And I understand that completely. I mean, the thing that's amazing is now everybody's got to do it. Right? Even the people in the classical subjects. And that's the amazing, that's the mode two world. Right, the mode two world is where the business school becomes the model for the university.
Because these business schools make money, you know, everywhere. When I speak to my friends, this is the idea. You know, the university has to create my dean. You will meet him tomorrow when we have wine tasting, appropriately. He's talking about, we have to generate our own income.
Sure. No, let me give you the okay. Let me. Here's a contrast for you. Warwick University, as you know, was founded with big business school. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and at the time it was found in the 1960s, everybody criticized this whole move. Turned out to be a brilliant move, though. But the idea, and this just shows you how classical we still are, right, was that the business school was designed as the money maker, right, but then the money would be redistributed to all the other faculties, so that they wouldn't be under such pressure to have to, you know, bring in money themselves. Okay, that was the idea, cross-subsidization. Okay, now that still retains the university ideal, okay? But now we're in an era, of course, where business schools and other professional schools want to retain more and more of the money they bring in, and what's happened now is, of course, and the rest of us have to kind of model our activities on your activities. We can't live off you anymore. We have to actually become like you, okay? And that's kind of where we are, right? That's sort of where we are, and that really does corrupt the university idea.
Well, it goes back to your discussion, which I think is very interesting, about what is to become human.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the autonomy argument, that this is a very powerful argument, you know, for me as a person, you know, to self-fulfill.
Yeah.
Why I'm doing what I'm doing.
Yeah.
What do I stand for?
Yeah.
And this idea of, you know, perhaps trying to do more about autonomy and not work all the time for clients, this is the balance that you have to do as a professor, I think.
Yes.
And this is, I don't know how other people feel here when they are trying to become professors or establish themselves, but I think this is the name of the game, isn't it?
Oh, God, yes. I mean, now, as you know, in Britain, we have folding chairs.
You know, that's to say professorships that give you, you get 5 years and then you have to be self-funding after that or your chair disappears.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? Folding chairs.
Yeah.
But it sounds to me like, you know, there are two really different, you know, opposing positions. Wouldn't we, you know, coming from Swedish settings, isn't it possible having some kind of consensus, you know?
The third way.
I mean, being hypocritical, saying one thing and just adding two pages and managerial implications in the end of the...
Oh, it's not so easy. You know. No, I mean... It's actually very funny you mentioned this. I just recently did a program evaluation for the ESRC, which is our Social Science Funding Council, on the Science and Society program, which had 46 projects, and it had a lot to, and people had to specify users and user benefits and all this kind of stuff. And it was, well, here's the thing. The academics did a very good job of specifying users and so forth in their grants and all this. But one of the things that I had to do in evaluating the program was to actually talk to these users, you know, and, well, you know what happened there. Basically, it was all showcase, right? It didn't have any impact, right? I mean, they didn't mind the academics putting their names down, and they attended a couple of functions every now and then, and maybe got an idea or two. But I couldn't find anyone who was willing to actually have a systematic interview, which would have actually, you know, asked them about how the project impacted on their practice and all this, because, you know, they really felt kind of embarrassed. They said, well, you know, I don't really think it, you know, you're wasting your time talking to me, even though I am the named user, you know. And so this is a real serious kind of, I mean, this from the issue of, especially for public funding bodies, this is a serious issue, right? So it's not enough for academics to be able to specify the users, because they've gotten very good in doing that. But then we're now in the stage of actually talking to the users. And if the users don't really register anything from the academic, then, and this matters. And if this, see, the thing is, this is a problem only if we really think users matter. You see, because there's going to be a point at which we can't just talk the talk, we've got to be able to walk the walk on this. And we're not walking, we may be talking the talk, but we're not walking the walk. And the problem is, if we do have to walk the walk, this may mean a really radical reorientation of research. That's my point. I mean, I actually had to say this in my report. And I'm someone who is very ambivalent about users having any kind of say in the research. But the thing I had to conclude was, yeah, they're specifying users like crazy, but the users aren't using the stuff. I mean... Oh, okay. Oh, my God, yes. 2 hours. Time flies when you're having fun.
Great fun. Thank you very much, Steve.